Mr. Secretary, the most topical thing in the world at the moment is South Vietnam. And earlier today, Senator Keating of New York, in a television broadcast, said, "The time has certainly come for a full-scale congressional investigation of the whole South Vietnam situation. The fact of the matter is, we've seen in U.S. politics towards South Vietnam over the past months the same dangerous tendency we saw in Cuba. Washington, he says, is rejecting the advice of people on the scene." Have you any comment on that?
Well, we don't object, Mr. Smith, to a congressional investigation of the Department of State on any particular subject. There are about a half dozen committees or subcommittees of the Congress that are looking very closely at what we do all the time. But this won't provide any answers for Vietnam. The appropriate committees or subcommittees of the Congress are in touch with Vietnam all the time. It's very easy to say that if we don't find exactly what we want in Vietnam, we should pull out. Or it's very easy to say that we should give full support to everything that the government does, regardless of what that is, in the interest of getting on with the war. But it is much more complicated than that. President Kennedy said in his press conference the other day that our objective there is to win the war. Now, everything that tends to help win the war, including the solidarity of the South Vietnamese people, we're in favor of. And so our problem is how to find a way to give support to what is in effect a very simple policy in the complexities of the local scene. Now, there are many members of Congress who are fully aware of this, and the mere process of investigation won't turn up any miraculous answers. There are no evil people in the woodwork anywhere, either in Saigon or in Washington, trying to get in the way of this effort. The problem is on the merits. How can the South Vietnamese people themselves be fully mobilized in behind the effort to bring about an independent and free South Vietnam? That's why we are there. When that is accomplished, we're glad to go home. Well, and that's the problem.
Can I ask you that very question?
Yes.
How can this be done? There have been expressions of confusion as to what course of action we're following. The president, in an interview, put public pressure on Diem to make changes, and then in a subsequent interview said we shouldn't put too much pressure because he may collapse.
Well, this is not the first time that this kind of issue has arisen in this post-war world in which the United States has been so much involved. Obviously, if the Buddhists feel that they do not have a place in the national life, or if the students and the intellectuals feel that they are being excluded from the national life, or if there's great difficulty with the press, difficulties with which you are fully familiar, it's very difficult to get balanced and fair press reporting of the actual situation in a country of that sort. And the relation between the government and the leadership in Saigon on the one side and the government and the villages on the other, all these things are crucial to the kind of solidarity that is needed. And so we have seen since May some deterioration in that solidarity. It was going well for the first 6 months of this year. But in June and July, incidents occurred which have eroded that solidarity. Now, there's no question about our pulling out, but we are deeply concerned about how to get on with the main objective, both for the main objective of the Vietnamese and our own. And so we'll be in a period here of some strain and some difficulty for a while, but I'm confident that the answers will be found by the Vietnamese government and that our assistance will continue to be effective.
Mr. Secretary, I'd like to ask you a question about South Vietnam, and it may sound a little argumentative, but it's not. It's the only way I know to get down to a basic question of policy. The president said the other day he firmly believed in the domino theory, that is, that one area after another will topple if one goes. Now, the question is, are we not possibly deluding ourselves by believing in the domino theory when something else is in fact the great danger? China went to the communists because of an incompetent government that we were supporting. After that thing stabilized, there was no domino action. Then North Vietnam went again because of an incompetent government that had lost its roots in the people that our side was supporting. And now, once again, after a period of stability, we face the same problem, worrying about the domino theory, but in fact, what seems to be weakening the country is a government that's lost its roots in the people.
Well, I think an analogy such as the domino theory has limited application, but in the case of Southeast Asia, I think it does have some utility. After all, there would be no pressures on Southeast Asia had the mainland of China not become communist. Now, back in 1949-50, along in there, we and the British and the French, agreed that the security of Southeast Asia depended upon the security of the Red River Valley in North Vietnam. Now, 1954, when the agreements were made which split Vietnam, and North Vietnam, in effect, became communist, that exposed Laos and indeed South Vietnam itself to further pressures from a communist North Vietnam. I think there's no question that if Laos were to go communist, or if South Vietnam were to go communist, that this would move on into the next stage of the communist attempt to get on with their world revolution in Thailand, Malaya, and wherever else. So we are dealing here not with a theory such as the domino theory, but with the fact that the communist world believes that a world revolution is going to encompass the entire globe. And wherever they find a chance to push their influence, not necessarily by war, but by guerrillas and by agents and by pressures of all sorts, they will take advantage of it. Now, I've speculated about what might have been the result had President de Gaulle been in charge of French policy in those years, like in 1949, 50, 52, 54, when a solution for Southeast Asia was being sought. I think it might well have been different, because he has acted with great courage and statesmanship on similar issues in other parts of the world. But I think there's no question that the loss of mainland China to the communists put great pressures upon Southeast Asia, and that the loss of North Vietnam exposed Laos and South Vietnam to those pressures. And I have no doubt that the loss of South Vietnam or Laos would bring additional pressures on Cambodia and Thailand and other countries. So if we need to find a simple phrase, the domino theory is good enough for me.
Now, you just mentioned General de Gaulle. He made public a statement the other day that understandably irked a lot of people, and that was to the effect that he was willing to help North and South Vietnam unite and get rid of foreign influences. Would it not be possibly wise to, rather than be irked by that statement, to assume that it's a consummation we devoutly wish to, and suggest that he join us in trying to achieve that, and possibly even share the expenses of it?
I have the impression that President de Gaulle's statement was a statement aimed at the long-term future and the eventual solution of the Vietnamese problem. And indeed, that was eventual solution that the governments concerned contemplated in 1954 when they signed the basic agreements about Southeast Asia. But it's one thing to look toward what might come eventually in the future, and another thing to talk about trying to unite these two parts of Vietnam under the present leadership of North Vietnam. Now, there are those who have some trouble with the quality of the leadership, or shall I say the general life in South Vietnam. But look at North Vietnam. If the alternative is between these two, there's no question about where the choice of free peoples would lie. Now, I don't myself see the possibility of a unification so long as Ho Chi Minh and his active communist-dominated group is dominant in North Vietnam. If it were possible, and I would think that Laos would be the first test, if it were possible that governments in Southeast Asia could be genuinely independent, unencumbered by Cold War attachments, either to the communist bloc or to, shall we say, the West, genuinely independent and free, then that's something that's very attractive, because in a country like Laos, they have no other real interest. The Laotians are very interesting people. They don't like to kill each other. And Souvanaphouma, just the other day, the prime minister in Paris, pointed out that if all the foreigners would get out of Laos, the Laotians would, I think he said, would go back to singing and to laughter.
Mr. Secretary, Madame Nu of South Vietnam is on her way here. Will she be welcomed or invited to Washington for a conversation?
I have no recent or firm information about her plans or her travel plans. I think she's indicated that if she were to come, she would not want to see officials, that she would prefer to see you people of the press.
Let me change the subject now to the debate on the atomic test ban.
Right.
The begrudging manner of much of the comment on this thing, which is really a very small step towards controlling the arms race, does that suggest to you that we would have an extremely hard time taking a second step in the direction of real disarmament?
Well, it seems to me that this partial nuclear test ban treaty has been a classic example of the performance by the Senate of its great historical and constitutional responsibility. When we negotiated this treaty, we were not unaware of what we consider to be the prevailing view of the Senate on the matter. We'd had many conversations with committees and with individual senators on the subject. But it's the president's responsibility to negotiate a treaty with foreign countries. Then he submits it for the advice and consent of the Senate. Now, I've been to a number of those hearings on the subject. I've met with more than one committee, and I've seen the testimony that has been brought forward. It would be very hard to find the most theoretical kind of question that has not been thoroughly and exhaustively explored by these responsible committees and by the Senate. And I think that as an American, one must say that the Senate is performing a great role in an absolutely superb fashion in looking at every aspect of this treaty. Now, it's true that there have been those who have expressed deep concern about it and reservations about any further steps in disarmament. But let's look at the vote when it's finally given. By and large, I think it can be demonstrated that if possible, if it is reasonable, possible, and in keeping with our security, the American people are in favor of the right kind of disarmament. We brought our military establishment down to almost $10 billion after World War II. It's now more than five times $10 billion. This is not the way we would prefer to spend our resources. We're prepared to do it if the world situation makes it necessary. Now, I must say, Mr. Smith, and I hope I'm not too, I don't want to appear too negative on this, I think that disarmament is one of the most complex questions in the world, and I do not anticipate any shoot-to-shoot of a whole series of far-reaching disarmament measures at this point, because disarmament really is linked to political settlement. And we've got many difficult and dangerous problems right around the world, Laos and Vietnam and Cuba and Berlin and other things. If those questions could be settled, disarmament would take care of itself. You couldn't get the American people to support large defense budgets if there were not those outstanding problems. So we must try to settle those problems. We must try to find some way to put a ceiling on the arms race. If we look forward to another 15 years in which our defense budget will multiply by four times as it has in the last 15 years, this is not a very pleasant or safe prospect for the future of the world. So I don't interpret this debate in the Senate as imposing any limits on what we can try to accomplish in the disarmament field. But I'll have to say that the problems of disarmament themselves are formidable, and the relations among great powers are complicated. And so I think that we won't see dramatic and far-reaching disarmament steps, say, in the next few weeks or months.
Now, I've noticed that most of the misgivings expressed by both senators and military men, however they're expressed, when boiled down, come to a suspicion that Russia has something up her sleeve we don't know about. What is your estimate of Russia's motives in agreeing now to a treaty that they have refused so long?
Well, I think they made, it's undoubtedly very mixed from their point of view. I'm sure they have made some judgments that this treaty would be in their interest, as we have made judgments that this treaty would be in our interest. But they do have, I think, important problems inside the bloc. They have important problems in the allocation of resources. And you know, I think all of us, back last October, including the leadership of the Soviet Union, were somewhat sobered by the fact that nuclear powers had to look operationally at the possibility of a nuclear war for the first time in history, really, for the first time in history. Now, when you look at that prospect, I think that you're stimulated to find out whether you cannot bring this great power, this great destructive power, under better controls than we have it at the present time. Now, so I think that that this is a matter in which it could be in both countries' interests. There's no question about the destructive power of the United States if anyone should attack us. But you know, that's not entirely comforting and is not really the path to security. I must say I was very much impressed with a remark that Mr. Khrushchev addressed to the Chinese. President Kennedy quoted that not long ago. Mr. Khrushchev said to the Chinese that in a thermonuclear war, the survivors would envy the dead. Now, here's a man who knows something about what nuclear war means. And I think I'd know a little about it, and I would say that this is essentially the underlying fact of our modern life.
Mr. Rusk, the dispatches this morning from the State Department say that you have now arranged to meet Mr. Gromyko very soon and to talk about next steps. Is there anything you could tell us about the lines you might like to pursue that are most promising or least unpromising towards next steps after this treaty?
Well, I do expect and look forward to seeing Mr. Gromyko while he's here for the General Assembly. I'd hope he'd find it possible to visit Washington while he's here before he goes back. There are some further possible disarmament measures being discussed in Geneva and on which we're consulting with our allies in NATO, particularly additional steps on against a surprise attack. The Soviets have indicated some interest in stationing static control inspectors around at ports and railway centers and airfields and places of that sort. It may be that something could be worked out along that line. The Soviets have indicated an interest in what they call a non-aggression pact. Well, this is being discussed in NATO. We've indicated that that's something that involves our allies, and we could not go very far on that without full discussion with our allies. And the President's indicated also that such a pact would be related to assurances with respect to the security of West Berlin and questions of that sort. There may be some other points, but I just want to point out that you can disagree fast. It takes time to find agreement.
Well, let me go after another line of questions now, looking back to the past. We're about to enter an election year, and certainly, inevitably, one of the issues is going to be your stewardship of the nation's foreign affairs. And Governor Rockefeller virtually began the inquisition this week by saying that things have deteriorated very badly since the Democrats took over. He cited what he called deterioration in Southeast Asia. Cuba, in this period, has become a very strong militarily Soviet ally in this hemisphere. The alliance has great discord in the alliance. I would like to ask you if you have any rebuttal to that. How do you view the record so far?
Well, Mr. Smith, we're doing business with 112 governments in a period of history which is characterized by rapid and fundamental change. I suppose during this calendar year there will be 35 to 40 changes of government somewhere in the world. So it's a little complicated to try to keep a score sheet. But I'm sure that this will be discussed at least next year and already beginning to be discussed this year. I think a president and a secretary of state who are in office find themselves concentrating upon the unfinished business ahead rather than trying to total up the scores. But I suppose the score will be discussed in due course. Now, going back to the major problems that President Kennedy faced when he took office, Laos and Cuba and Congo and Berlin, those are the key dangerous questions at that point. I would think that Laos is substantially better than it was at that point. At that time, the neutralists and the Viet Cong were working together, supported by a Russian airlift, to try to destroy the then conservative government. At the present time, the neutralists and the former conservative government are working together. There is no large Russian airlift coming in. And the prime minister of the country refers to the two sides now, the government and the neutralists on the one side, Viet Minh on the other. Now, so I think there's significant improvement there. Congo, it has improved almost beyond recognition, although there are some very serious questions still remaining in order to build there on the foundation that has now been created by a vigorous and, I think, very effective United Nations effort. Berlin is not solved, but it is not a point of highest danger and tension as it was 2 years ago or 4 years ago. Cuba is still there as a problem. Cuba during 1960 became a communist country, and our problem has been to find a cure since prevention had not been possible. Now, in 1960, for example, the rest of the hemisphere was not very much concerned about Cuba, and they rather were attracted by the idea. At the present time, the hemisphere is fully alert to the nature of this threat. The armed forces of the United States are committed to those measures which would prevent Cuba from becoming any military threat to us or to its neighbors. The inter-American countries are working together in fine cooperation to interrupt any flow of subversion and that kind of thing from Cuba into other countries. And I must say that all of our reports indicate that the present regime in Cuba must surely know by now that the present course upon which they're embarked has no future in it for the Cuban people or for themselves. And so, although that problem is still with us, I think that it is being put into its right place in the urgency and the importance of things, both here and in other countries in the hemisphere. So, but at the same time, and I don't want to be unfair on this, other things pop out. 112 countries mean that something can happen every day. The tensions between India and Pakistan have increased because there's been a basic failure to, by them, primarily because it's their problem, to settle the Kashmir question. But when you look into the communist world, you find there deep differences between Moscow and Beijing. And you find, interestingly enough, the element of consent moving into the relations between the Eastern European countries and Moscow.
Mr. Secretary, I surmise that the biggest problem you're going to have in an election year is talking about those Russian troops in Cuba. Why, when the missile crisis was at its peak and we were getting the upper hand, why did we not maintain the blockade of Cuba until the Russians took the troops out?
Well, Mr. Smith, the measures that you take in a given situation have to be related to the nature of the threat, primarily against the United States. The missiles in Cuba were a deadly threat to us, and therefore we had to take whatever measures were necessary to see that that threat was removed. But we were on the brink of nuclear war, and there was the problem of how far that kind of highest tension should be sustained and for what purposes, because if we had come to a breaking point there, this would not have affected just Cuba. It would have affected the entire northern hemisphere in the most devastating fashion. And so we felt that the measures that were taken to remove the direst threat were the heart of the matter. And when that threat was removed, we take a little time for the others. The president indicated in his press conference the other day that he thought these troops, and I do too, that these troops were moving out. The problem is not so much units now as technicians and advisors.
Excuse me, I think our time's up. Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary, for coming here on Issues and Answers.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Today's guest has been the Secretary of State, the Honorable Dean Rusk. He was interviewed by ABC commentator Howard K. Smith. Next week at the same time, Issues and Answers will bring you the Prime Minister of Canada, the Honorable Lester Pearson. We hope you'll join us. Issues and Answers is produced by Peggy Wheaton, a presentation of ABC News. News live every hour on the ABC Radio Network.